Hello and welcome to the 538 Politics Podcast. I'm Galen Druk.
I'm Nate Silver.
And this is Model Talk.
We're a little bit more subdued that time because we're actually in a room in which other people can hear us.
Yeah, before we get started, and in case this podcast sounds any different, Nate and I are both in Boston at the MIT Sloan Sports Analytics Conference, so we ducked into this conference room in order to record this podcast. I happen to be in Boston. Nate, you're actually here because you do sports analytics. I don't know anything about sports analytics.
Wait, you're not here for this event?
No. You just happen to be here? Just happen to be here. Anyway, let's get right to it because we don't have a lot of time and our listeners have a lot of questions about the model. So it's been 3 days since Super Tuesday and the model is, as of today, back up and running, and it shows some pretty dramatic changes. According to the Democratic primary forecast, Joe Biden now has an 87% chance of getting the majority of delegates. There's a 10% chance no one wins a majority and a 3% chance that Bernie Sanders wins it. Before Super Tuesday, just for context, there was a 61% chance of no one winning the majority, 31% chance of Biden winning it, and 8% chance for Sanders. So just starting off generally, Nate, why such a dramatic shift?
Because Joe Biden kicked ass on Super Tuesday. I mean, I don't know, like, I'm sounding a little cheeky, right? But like, our model is supposed to reflect what happens in the real world. When you have Joe Biden winning states like Massachusetts, Maine, and Minnesota, when you have him winning these southern states by 20 or 30 point margins, when you have him winning Texas by 5 points, basically winning everything except the states where you had mail balloting kind of before his surge. He's losing California by 8. I'll let margin might tighten as additional ballots are collected. This was kind of a 90 or 95th percentile outcome for Biden. Meanwhile, you have other candidates dropping out, obviously. And so the chance of a multi-way race has gone, you know, unless Tulsi Gabbard has a surge, who knows?
Right, that's why that no one chance has gone down so much, because there are only two.
Yeah, because before you had, I mean, both Warren and Bloomberg kind of underachieved their delegate forecast, but it's most important that they dropped out, right? So they have no more opportunity to collect future delegates.
I want to get into that a little bit more, but just to kind of set the baseline here, we talked about the lack of information going into Super Tuesday on Monday, given that there just weren't that many national polls or state-level polls for that matter. So how did Tuesday's results compare with what we expected going in?
I mean, they were within a boundary, right? I mean, I think almost everything kind of fell within our 80% confidence intervals, at least. I haven't looked at all of those, if not probably the 90% confidence intervals. I mean, you know, Massachusetts and Maine and Minnesota are all decent-sized upsets. If we had had 4 or 5 polls in every state and 4 or 5 polls in national polls post-South Carolina, maybe, you know, it's, you know, this happened very fast. Our model did have them ahead in Texas, even though only one poll did. It did see these big margins in the southern states, and so, you know, so it kind of captured 2/3 of it, and I think if we had had more polling, it would have captured the other third, but, like, that's why it has these big kind of error bars, is because, like, you know, sometimes you don't actually have a comprehensive rundown of what the polling says before a certain event.
Somebody called Aspiring Optimist on Twitter asks, why did it take 3 days to update the model?
God, Galen, you're, you know, interrogating me here, man.
No, Aspiring Optimist is. But that, you know, that's an obvious question for a lot of our listeners. I'm sure your DMs and whatever at messages have been off the charts with people asking. I know you don't check them, but in terms of people asking where the model is, whether or not it's updating. So what have you been doing over the past 3 days in order to get to this point?
So there are basically three kind of buckets here. One bucket is that results were and remain incomplete in many states, most importantly California. We have to decide, do we want to try and make some extrapolations for that? There are some congressional districts where you don't have any results yet, even though districts are, or delegates are awarded at the congressional district level, so that can be a problem. So there's a question about, like, can we wait a little bit? What extrapolations do we want to make? Bucket number two is just there is coding stuff, by which I mean this was the first day in which you had multiple primaries on the same day. It turns out that some code that worked when you had one primary occurring did not work when you had multiple primaries occurring. And so
what specifically?
It's not exciting, right?
Oh, okay.
It's just there are 10,000 lines of code or something, right? And it's not totally uncommon where the first time you test a certain parameter or test a certain, you know, first time you run the code, right? If two of those 10,000 lines of code weren't properly tested for, like, when you have multiple primaries in the same day, then the program will either fail or produce incorrect results, right? And so
some of it was just fixing code that had already been written, and it now does what it was intended to do, but the overall forecast model has not been changed. I think some people did ask, though, on Twitter, that there's a third category where some things did change. What did change?
So the model spit out, obviously, a very confident number on Biden, and we wanted to examine a couple of assumptions. One assumption concerns, like, so the model in states where we don't have polling, like there's no polling in Mississippi, for example, or no recent polling, at least. The model uses a combination of past results and polls in other states to estimate how well you'll do. Without getting too into the weeds, even though this is model talk, the fact that Biden outperformed his polls on Tuesday creates kind of an implicit assumption in the model that he'll outperform his polls in other states. And we're not sure that we necessarily love that assumption.
Just because, to some extent, it was a lack of data that was the reason outperformed.
The issue is,
and
like,
in the future, we may not have that
lack of
data.
The issue is, like, if you assume, oh, he's at wherever the model had him at, 26% nationally, and he's got these results, then that must mean that he really beats his polls. But he probably wasn't 26% nationally. He was probably at 33% nationally and then got 35% or something. You know what I mean? So the fact that you didn't actually have like a stable national polling average pre-Super Tuesday, but just in general, like, we found that there tends not to be that much carryover. If you overperform your polls in one state, it doesn't necessarily mean that you beat your polls in the next state. And so we basically now adjust the demographic projections, most of which they kind of match the state polls. We don't care about the national polls, but they match the state polls. So therefore, that wound up hedging a bit on Biden. And then the last category is like, one question is there's been a lot of polling volatility recently. And the question is, people can say, oh, well, it seems like polls went up. Biden went up 10 points. Couldn't he just go back down 10 points, right? And the answer to that is probably not. But there are short-term spikes and lulls and polling volatility. It's kind of like just like the stock market. So we looked at that and we're like, okay, let's make sure. Because the whole game now for Bernie Sanders is he has to make up a lot of ground in a hurry, right? Some of the narrative is like, well, things could shift back to Bernie Sanders. It's like they could, but 38% of delegates have already been picked. He already, and 35 of those 38% were on Super Tuesday. So he already really underperformed now in a third of the country, which means you have to perform even better in the remaining two-thirds to make up for that. And you have like another big chunk of delegates over the next 2.5 weeks. And so he needs a dramatic shift toward him fast, right?
So in terms of changes to the model, it just accounts for maybe more polling volatility, so doesn't react as dramatically to shifts in polls. Is that what you're saying?
No. It's saying that it accounts for the possibility for polls to shift further.
Again, okay.
Yeah.
So given that, do you think that if you had made this adjustment before states started voting and we had all of that volatility post-Iowa and then post-South Carolina, that maybe the forecast wouldn't have shifted as much during those times?
No, because there wasn't that much volatility.
Well, I mean, after Iowa there was, right?
That's normal, though.
Okay.
Yeah, that's pretty normal volatility.
But
like, this has been overall like a fairly stable campaign.
But at post-Iowa, would it have still given Biden a better shot if it had said, well, there's a chance that the volatility could continue?
No, because I think the amount of volatility for Biden is kind of average, right? So it wouldn't have affected things that much.
So the kind of post-Iowa fall and post-South Carolina rise is pretty average?
The Iowa fall is pretty average. The post-South Carolina rise is extremely steep and sudden and is more on the way toward being something you might see once every few cycles instead of typical for a cycle. Like, the best comparison is probably to John Kerry in 2004 after he won Iowa. So it does have some precedence. But that is, that's in like kind of the 96th percentile or something of polling surges. Whereas everything that happened before it, actually some of the bounces were pretty mild and things were pretty stable and polling was pretty stable for all of last year, right? I mean, people just got to go back and look at data series of like what primary polls look like, right? People are shocked when things move by like 5 or 6 points. I mean, that's nothing. That's like below average, right?
Right. I think people are mostly not reacting to 2019, but just reacting to the past month or so and the ups and downs post-Iowa. And to that point, we got several questions along this line, and I'll just read the one from Jake. He says, you know, within the past month, we've gone from Sanders with a 48% chance and Biden in the low teens to Biden now with an 88% chance and Sanders at 3%. With sways like that, what do you think the efficacy of having a model is? How is it helping? Who is it helpful for? And he says, to me, this mostly says the race was unpredictable at any given moment, and it wasn't that helpful for me to pay attention to the model day in, day out. So,
well, but first
Jake,
of all,
Jake also says, caveats here, I'm a longtime listener, so this isn't an attack.
Well, isn't that the right lesson then? That the race is fairly unpredictable, then all of a sudden the entire country votes on Tuesday and now it's predictable? Like, that seems like a good model to me, right? It seems like a good model that we never had Bernie above, maybe briefly in a couple model runs, but he never got above 50% for a majority, even though people said he was inevitable, right? It seems good that Biden was never priced down to 0%, as some other candidates were. I mean, it was very bullish, or bearish, rather, on Buttigieg the whole race. It was very bearish on Bloomberg, although with a brief interval of slightly less bearishness. It was initially gave Warren a shot even after she was third in Iowa, but that diminished to close to zero over time and never at all bought into a Klobuchar surge possibility. So the fact that it said, okay, there are really three plausible outcomes here, Bernie, no majority, or Biden, and you get a lot more clarity kind of which one of those you get after Super Tuesday. I mean, you know, I mean, it's not like super prescient, but like, you know, to us, like the fact that it was always bullish on Biden relative to the consensus view. It never got totally out of line on Bernie, right? I mean, his plurality chances got up to like 70% at their peak, which is also not that high, right? Even though you're like, how could Bernie lose, right? He's won the first three states. So to me, like, I think it seems like it handled that fairly well. And you want, like, good models should have sharp inflection points, right? People want models that, like, slowly move, right? But those, first of all, they have a problem called autocorrelation, which is that you can predict what the model will say in period Y based on what it says in period X, right? So if it's like, if it goes from like 30 to 40, you can predict that the model will go to 50 the next day. If that's the case, then you should just have it be at 50 right now, right? And so models that are properly calibrated to, this is very technical, right? But to minimize autocorrelation so that our forecast on the current day is also the best prediction of what the forecast will be the next day. Models that satisfy that property are more aggressive sometimes than people might expect intuitively.
And so to the practical point of Jake's question, how should people in their daily lives be using the forecast in order to understand politics?
They should be differentiating between things that are kind of in four buckets, right? Things that are almost certain, things that are quite possible or more likely than not, things that are faintly possible, and then things that are next to impossible. And the notion that, like, a big Biden surge was, you know, faintly possible, maybe a little bit more than faintly, and that Biden was strong enough that if he were to have a surge, he could capitalize on that. Whereas if Klobuchar is starting, so if you start out at 16% and you surge 13 points, right, then you're at 28 or 30 on Super Tuesday, you win a lot of states. If you start at 4% and you surge 13 points, then you kind of wind up in the Buttigieg zone, right? And so, you know, the fact that Biden always had this strength, he never fell below 15 or 16% in national polls, which is higher than Mayor Pete ever got in national polls. And the betting markets at one point had, like, Klobuchar, I think, as being, like, more likely to win the nomination than Biden when she was at 5% and he was at 15% and her best states had happened and his hadn't happened yet.
So to keep your expectations in check, we have some more questions from listeners I want to get to. But first, today's podcast is brought to you by ADT Commercial for Business. It's not politics as usual these days, and it's not business as usual at ADT. ADT Commercial serves businesses ranging from mid-sized organizations to large-scale enterprises. Think of them as national security advisors just for your company. They provide comprehensive security, fire, life safety, and risk management solutions, professional-grade systems for commercial-grade businesses. Businesses choose ADT Commercial. The Fortune 1000 trust ADT Commercial for highly complex, scalable, integrated solutions. And if you're looking for a great partner to upgrade or take over the monitoring and service of your current system, ADT Commercial can help to install and maintain large-scale and multi-site business dependably. Businesses choose ADT Commercial for their complex security solutions. Visit ADT.com/538 to learn more. Again, that's ADT.com/538. We're back, and this is continuing on a similar theme, and then we have some more questions to get to. But Jennifer asks, are there any particular strengths or problems that you've noticed so far in the model? Because this is the first time we're doing this primary forecast model overall.
I mean, I didn't think the change we made last night about like looking at short-term volatility would be helpful in some cases. Actually, the one case where it might have been helpful is like this fairly rapid Bloomberg ascent, right? It would have said, okay, well, it's very volatile, but could go in either direction, right? That might have been helpful.
So if we had implemented this earlier, that's a change that you...
Because Bloomberg did have one of those rapid ascents, right? And it wasn't a state-driven balance. It was more like kind of separate from that. Or like would have been good with Kamala Harris's surge, although we wouldn't have the model on that early anyway, right? But a case like that in June would have been helpful. I think the model has convinced us, or not the model, but like kind of the results from last night, from
last
Tuesday.
Last night, we're
oh
so tired.
Oh my God. Oh my God, Galen.
How much sleep have you gotten in the past 3 days?
You know, I don't really want to tally it up. several hours. No. So I think Tuesday was a really good example of where early voting can matter, actually, where states with a lot of early voting were much less good for Biden than states with little or no early voting. And so maybe in our general election model, we'll account for if there are sudden shifts in the polls, they'll be dampened in states with a lot of early voting. That could be kind of important.
Yeah, that's interesting.
The logic of when candidates drop out, it's kind of hard to capture. I mean, I think we don't want to make like overly prescriptive assumptions in the model about like kind of when candidates drop out, right? But like those assumptions matter a lot because like the fact that it had the still majority being fairly high was not just because, it was not necessarily because like the forecast for the candidates were that optimistic. It was because like if you stay in, you keep accumulating delegates, if there's even one major candidate in apart from Biden and Sanders, and it's not that hard to get 15%, right? And so, you know, so I think the model would have thought it was unlikely that everyone dropped out, and that kind of resembled strategic behavior by the candidates. I think we make assumptions about if someone drops out, where their voters go. If there's an immediate endorsement, then that seems to be more different than if there isn't an endorsement. The problem is it's actually pretty unusual for candidates to drop out and endorse immediately.
Right.
More so common is like Warren was like, why the f*** are you asking me about an endorsement? I just ran this grueling race. Obviously, like if I thought one of these two were clearly better, then I wouldn't have run the race myself, you know what I mean? So it was unusual to have like this kind of coordinated surge around Klobuchar and Buttigieg.
So even though Klobuchar and Buttigieg did immediately endorse, the model didn't consider that information. It more looked at who their coalitions were made up of and made assumptions about who they might go to based on that.
Yeah, I mean, if anything, I mean, like these extremely relevant in-state endorsements, I mean, we've looked at that and in general, but you know, the problem is like an average boring backbench senator from South Carolina, if there were a Democratic one, might not matter. But James Clyburn matters, right? A senator as popular as Amy Klobuchar probably matters. Gretchen Whitmer might matter in Michigan for Biden now.
So going forward, you might change how much weight you put on particular endorsements in states?
I don't know. I mean, you know, the fact that the model still put any weight at all on endorsements after 2016. But we looked at that specifically and we found that like in-state endorsements don't add very much relative to other metrics. But like this is, no, again, a case where it's like you have strategic targeted endorsements meant to produce a particular effect and not like, oh, you know, some senator or representative endorsed someone in this state 7 months ago, right? This is a little bit different where you really have almost like an intervention. And to some extent, it's like a model is not supposed to capture one specific in particular instance of behavior, right? It's supposed to like capture common generalizable patterns of behavior and then to account for enough uncertainty where things that you can account for that are one-off circumstances are within the kind of realm of like normal or normal-ish behavior, right?
Is there any sense that these primary races are just so different from one cycle to the next that trying to model them is a fool's errand anyway?
No, I think actually it's been quite helpful. I mean, like, because the basic parameters hold directionally, right? The basic parameters that winning states can produce big bounces that are sometimes very big and sometimes medium and occasionally non-existent, right? That seems important. It seems important that candidates are, there's some mean reversion taking place, right? And that for Biden, he still has some strengths as a candidate, and then maybe he can fall in the polls, but like there isn't momentum in the polls necessarily. You kind of find a bottom if you're Biden eventually. The notion that states move together and that if Biden surges, then he actually does surge across the board enough for him to win states that probably he had no business winning.
Yeah.
I mean, all of that stuff seems like directionally that it's something the model is quite valuable for. And again, like, it's important now that the model said, okay, Bernie at his peak got up to about a 50-50 chance of winning a majority, and Biden's now at 88% or whatever, right? Like, you know, if Biden does not win the majority, then that would be kind of more, you know, I mean, a 13% chance of it not happening is actually not that low, right? That's a decent, it's 1 in 8 or something, but like, but still, you know.
I mean, at this point, yeah, people are definitely going to give a shit at this point if Biden doesn't win the majority of delegates.
People
that's
give us the
without
shit
question.
No matter what, right? But 12% is not that low, right?
All right.
But if you had like Bloomberg, who at one point had a 0.2% chance of winning the majority, that probably is more of a sign that like something was misdesigned.
So Matthew asks, what would be the most helpful polls or data to get right now in order to better understand the race? Because we still actually don't have a ton of data post Super Tuesday.
Yeah, I mean, everything and everywhere, right? I would love more Michigan data. I mean, the polls are kind of historically been crappy in Michigan, but, you know, I guess some is better than none. And also Michigan, unlike in 2016, it's not clear. In 2016, it was like, okay, Hillary is way up, but, like, doesn't it seem like it should be, like, a pretty competitive state, right, demographically? Whereas, like, this time, it's like, I'm not actually sure that it's necessarily a Bernie state. He is not doing nearly as well among, relatively speaking, among white working class voters as they did in 2016, right? And if that's the case, then all of a sudden Michigan becomes a kind of bad state for him, right?
Yeah.
You know, very few Hispanic voters, some African-American voters, and a lot of white working class voters. Like, that seems almost more like in 2020, like a Biden state. So I have no strong priors in Michigan. I'd like to know what the polls say there.
And just to give listeners some perspective, our national polling average right now shows Biden at 35% and Sanders at 29%.
Yeah, and the national polling average is, like I said, like it's designed to be like a bit conservative. I mean, if you look at like kind of the morning consult poll, it has him up 14 points or something. I mean, if he's up 14 points and that sustains for itself for the next 2 weeks, then the race is extremely over.
Biden over Sanders, yeah.
Because you can't have the next third of delegates be selected with a 14-point deficit for Bernie and have him have any kind of like mathematical chance of coming back, right? So he has to like hope those polls are not representative or have a momentum shift in a hurry.
And this actually gets at a question that we got from Kennedy, which is, what is the difference between Biden and Sanders in 2020 versus Clinton and Sanders in 2016 at this point in the race?
I mean, it maybe actually isn't that different, right? Because Clinton kind of often had like a high single digit or low double digit lead over Sanders in national polls. The coalitions are different. I mean, keep in mind that Biden won several states. He won Oklahoma, he won Maine and Minnesota that Bernie won in 2016. And Bernie
walked away with them in 2016.
Yeah, although some were caucuses.
Minnesota,
I think, and Maine. I forget about Maine. But that Bernie will probably win, it hasn't been called yet, because there's still like millions of votes, literally, but will probably win California, which Hillary won in 2016. So the coalitions are different, and Bernie, I think, is doing much better among Hispanic voters than he did 4 years ago. But that Biden is much stronger among white working class voters than Clinton was. And rural kind of, you know, I mean, I think one thing that like Bernie's team, in hindsight, 2020, you know, I think if their campaign loses, then I don't think people should shame them too much, right? I mean, there are things to critique, and I'll probably have a critique up later on, right? But, like, I think it's important in a field of 27 candidates that, like, if you're the strong second-place candidate, that you probably deserve more credit than blame for that, which is not to say there aren't some things that we can critique about kind of their strategy, right? I think they probably made a mistake in not at the moment of their greatest ascension, not at the moment of Nevada, New Hampshire, kind of pivoting more toward a more inclusive message, right? Run the Obama embracing Bernie ad then do your stuff about how Bernie is open-minded about who the VP would be. It doesn't necessarily have to be someone who is another Medicare for All progressive. I mean, I don't know, but they're also playing the probabilities, and they might say, okay, well, no, sure, it seems all obvious now, but like a lot of things had to line up for
Biden.
This huge surge behind Biden, right? A lot of things had to line up.
I think we're still waiting for some of that behind-the-scenes reporting that's eventually going to come out. The TikTok, what President Obama had to do behind the scenes, what Harry Reid was doing, and all of that stuff, you know. Who knows?
But no, it does sound like a little bit like some... I was going to insult some particular writers. I won't. It does sound like some fanfic, right? Where if you wrote this script, right, you're like, here's how Biden's going to come back, right? If some bad Never Trump pundit wrote this script for a Biden comeback, you'd be like, nah, you lost me on Minnesota, right? You lost me on Amy Klobuchar's endorsement at the last minute, giving him a 9-point win in Minnesota. I don't believe that. Sorry. That's what happened, though.
Yeah. So we're going to wrap things up, and this is maybe more a preview for a conversation we'll have later on, but I want to ask this, at least just because the name of the person asking this question is so good. Bagel Dad on Twitter asks, what is the expected effect of the COVID progression on the remaining primaries?
It's not in the model.
Coronavirus, unfortunately, not in the model.
The interesting one is Washington State, where it's a bigger problem than elsewhere in the country, and that is this week. I mean, Washington, fortunately, is a vote-by-mail state. Eventually, we may encounter a case where,
New York's voting in April, and it seems like it's increasing.
New York, New Yorkers,
day by day.
We always got a little flu in New York. I don't think it's going to deter us from going to the polls.
Really?
New Yorkers don't panic.
Interesting.
Maybe they should. But you're going to have primaries where this is a big issue, potentially. Or imagine a caucus. I guess the Wyoming caucus, there's a COVID outbreak in Wyoming. That caucus is going to have to go virtual or something. But it's a big unprecedented source of uncertainty. I also wonder a little bit if it gives people more anxiety and that they revert toward making safer choices amidst anxiety, and that Biden is perceived as kind of this safe choice and Bernie is the high upside kind of bold choice. If we don't get Bernie, by the way, Bernie would be a very interesting test case for theories about electability.
Yeah.
So from a political science point of view, you should be kind of rooting for
Bernie Sanders' comeback.
Yeah.
Well, your mentions definitely aren't rooting for a Bernie Sanders comeback.
Okay. It is funny, by the way, how
the wild swings in people who were very excited in the Sanders camp about our projections 2 weeks ago versus now is really feeling it from all sides.
But the thing is, he'd really lost a lot of states on Tuesday, right? I was up at 5 in the morning trying to say, okay, are we sure that the model should be this confident in Biden? And the answer is we think so because the path is very hard for Bernie because of the timing of things, right? If you have a 3-week period now with no states and things could reset, have a debate. But now Biden is kind of on this high, which may or may not be sustainable. But the fact is that you have another huge chunk of states voting in the next 12 days or whatever.
Right. The one unknown, I guess, is that March 15th debate before a whole bunch of important states vote on the 17th.
Although a lot of those states, Florida, Arizona, have a lot of early voting, right? It's another problem for Bernie. I would love to see an Arizona poll, by the way. That's a state that, our model says, okay, lots of Hispanics in Arizona. For various reasons, we don't actually look at the age of a state. And so I think Arizona is a state where it might not be as good for Bernie as our model assumes, but I'd love to see some polling in Arizona. But Arizona, yeah, and Florida, lots of early voting, and so that debate might be a little bit late, actually, for those states.
Interesting.
But yeah, Bernie has to kind of turn things around quickly. And I mean, you're probably right that, maybe Biden is a mediocre debater. I mean, and now he's going to have to actually speak for half the time.
Right. I'm wondering how long they're going to have the debate for. I don't think it's going to be 2 hours, right?
Well, the networks want drama, right? As long as possible.
Yeah, but I don't think the campaigns or the DNC want that.
I mean, you know.
Sanders' campaign does want it. I don't think Biden's campaign wants it.
I mean, Sanders also hasn't quite... we're getting out of Molotov territory here.
Yeah.
He's been, I think, surprisingly ineffectual at kind of what he wants the driving argument he has against Biden to be.
All right, well, you have this conference to get back to, so I'll let you go for now. But thank you for joining me for the spontaneous model talk in this random conference.
Thank you for asking me these pointed questions.
My pleasure. Anyway, my name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is here with us on the audio controls. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.